Hi everyone and welcome to Auntie Monkey. I'm Andrew Robertson and this is the Ballooning Podcast. You may have noticed it's been quite a while since we've put out any new content. In fact, it's been a year and a half since we've released an episode. But we thought that during this time where everybody's stuck at home because of coronavirus and everybody's grounded, what better time to, I guess, take advantage of this captive audience and start releasing a few new episodes. But no, seriously, it is a really crappy time for balloonists at the moment. Not only are we all grounded, but a lot of our family and friends are really struggling. So many people have lost their jobs or they're just trying to keep their companies afloat. So our hearts are really going out to those people just to help them get through this hard time. So hopefully this won't go on too much longer, but we also hope that these episodes of Auntie Monkey will help give a bit of light relief during these periods of angst. So let's get on with the episode. Today, we're going to take a slightly different slant on the normal conversations that we have, because we're not talking to a balloon pilot. We're actually talking to a balloon crew person. And that person is Dino Pegg. Dino is a professional crew person here in Australia, but also has played a very active role as a team leader and a crew chief in the Australian ballooning team. Dino has travelled the world extensively, and anyone who's been to a big international competition will have met Dino because he's never shy of having a conversation with anyone, and he's always there at the targets with 1,000 pie balls, with providing the Australian team with a lot of valuable weather information. Dino is also an amazingly interesting person. I was privileged enough to spend a week with him in a van listening to all his stories, and every time I talk to Dino, you always find out something more amazing that he's done in his past life. But I'm not going to go into it too much detail because you can hear it for yourself. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dino Pegg. So Dino, welcome to Auntie Monkey. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for asking me to be on your podcast, mate. I feel quite humbled, a mere mortal being interviewed for a ballooning podcast.
Well, that was, I guess, what I was thinking about was we do obviously a lot of focusing on pilots and people like that, but there's a whole other segment of the ballooning world that we haven't really represented yet, which is the people that are not necessarily in the basket all the time. So for people that don't know you, I thought it might be worth just maybe giving a little bit of your background about how you got into ballooning, potentially.
Well, it was totally by accident. I was in a paddock at Camden Airport, minding my own business, looking after a family property here. And Peter Vizard landed in the paddock. And it was quite surreal, really, I don't think I'd ever seen a balloon up until this point. And that was around about mid-80s sometime, 85, I guess somewhere around about there. And we got talking and he needed a bloke to follow him around the place or to, you know, retrieve his balloon, help him pack it up. And I wasn't particularly interested in the balloon, but my sense of curiosity and for trying things new and different, I started following him around the place a bit. And that's how it all really started, I suppose.
You now currently live basically at Camden Airport. Were you living at the airport at the time?
I wasn't. I was visiting the MacArthur Onslow family, who I went to school with, a couple of the MacArthur Onslow family boys, which you may or may not have heard of a guy by the name of Kiff Saunders. He was one of them, and that was his family property. And I was in a gap in my life and ended up down here doing a bit of a work on the farm. And that was my first exposure to balloons. I think Kiff was either in the middle of his French policy apprenticeship or just doing his gap year, must have been his French polishing apprenticeship. So he was still going to TAFE at the time, I think.
And are you the one that's responsible for Kiff then getting into ballooning, or is that a sort of parallel coincidence?
Oh, I think it was pretty much a parallel coincidence more than anything. I think we sort of first exposed to balloons at around about the same time, around about that mid-80s time. And I was doing my thing, which was more agricultural based. And I think, you know, his history in aviation through his family, it pushed his buttons, and he picked it up and started crewing himself.
So I want to get, we'll talk a little bit later about the ballooning stuff, but one of the things that I've always been very fascinated with you is that you've done a lot prior to the ballooning world. And I had the pleasure of spending a week sitting in a van in Japan with you probably 5 or 6 years ago, and start hearing all the stories about what you used to do. I wouldn't mind if you don't mind poking into some of those things, because I believe at one point you were trying out for the, or part of the Commonwealth pistol shooting team. Is that right?
Yeah. So my father was a pretty outdoorsy sort of guy. So I spent a lot of my childhood years hunting, fishing, sailing, did a fair bit of sailing as well, because he had a Navy background when he was young. And I ended up target shooting when I was at school. And it went from there, really. I was shooting at school at Blue Mountains Grammar School up at Wentworth Falls. I was up there 6 years, and it was owned by the King's School. And a number of the guys that I used to compete against used to go to King's, and inadvertently we formed the junior New South Wales team between the four of us, which is four shooters in a competition team. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time going between Wentworth Falls and Parramatta training and shooting small bore target rifles. And then when I left school and went to the bush, once the property owners realised that I was pretty handy with a rifle, I was directed to a lot of vermin control and culling of wildlife, what I see now as wildlife, across large parts of New South Wales, Queensland, and to a smaller degree in the Northern Territory. So spent a lot of time killing shit.
Yeah. And I'm assuming that's not something that you're doing these days quite as much.
No. I gave that away probably 20-odd years ago, but it's a bit like riding a bike, but I'm a little bit more environmentally conscious, or a lot more environmentally conscious these days, but karmically I'm screwed.
And I think, I also believe that at one point you were also a stockbroker in another one of your guises in your life.
Yeah, well, my father was, he was in the Royal Australian Navy during the Korean War, and originally I was, had my heart set on a career in the Navy, and did the officer training college entrance exams at Jervis Bay in the early 70s. I think I was about 14 or 15 at the time. And Dad, when he left the Navy, he started working on the Australian Stock Exchange, and then went from there to running a couple of the larger merchant banks in Australia, and ended up one of the foundation members of the Futures Exchange. So by the time I'd been in the bush for, I don't know, 6, 8 years or whatever it was, I injured myself in a mustering accident and badly damaged one of my legs. And while I was convalescing, that was Dad's opportunity to, do the father and son thing and bring me into the business. So I started as a floor runner on the Sydney Futures Exchange. And then I went on to do my license as a trader. And as soon as my leg was healed, I couldn't get out of the place fast enough. So it was a short career, but I certainly proved to Dad I had it in me. And I now, in hindsight, thank him for that opportunity, because it allows me to make some pretty sensible decisions on what to do with money and how to play the game. So not that I play futures, but I enjoy a bit of a dabble in the stock market here and there.
I'm just trying to picture you in a suit, having known you for probably 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, I brush up pretty well in a suit, mate. I'm having gone to boarding school and being whipped into wearing suits. I feel very comfortable in a suit, and I know how to dress and when to dress and where to dress. So yeah, I have no problems with that, and I look quite hot in a suit, just quite.
I guess coming back to your sort of the ballooning life, so you obviously got into the commercial ballooning side of things fairly early, but you've also been very active in a lot of the competition stuff in more recent years. I guess what I wanted to sort of talk to you about is kind of some of the great experiences that you've had over the years, whether it's internationally or some of the more local stuff in Australia. So firstly, I guess in those early days of commercial ballooning, can you talk a little bit about some of the travel and some of the adventures you got up to?
Well, it was sort of a very strange transition because, as I said earlier, I'd been working at Camden Airport on the property here, and it didn't really push my buttons. It all looked a bit dodgy to me in the early days, sort of, I'd say, between the 80s and the early 90s. And then once Kip Saunders got his commercial license and started to build his hours, he was in Victoria at that time at Benalla, I think. And he came up to visit the place one time around about 95 or 96, and he did a bit of a Martin Luther King on me. And we were talking about ballooning, and he said, "I have a dream." And this was a pretty ambiguous statement to me because, as I said, I was very much on the peripheral of ballooning and it was pretty superficial to me. But Kip took me and my wife and my daughter down to Victoria, and he said, "Oh, I've got a bit of an idea of what I want to do in the ballooning industry, and I need your help." So being the loyal subject that I am, I said, "Sure, mate, not a problem." And he had quite a few interesting ideas about ballooning, which were, I wouldn't say diametrically opposed, but they were certainly different to what I'd already seen. And that's what pushed my buttons, was, wow, you know, this is cool. This is good. And subsequently went on to be a ballooning tragic, I suppose you could say. I'm addicted to it. I can't get enough of it. And I find that it's, doesn't really matter where you are, it's just the most fascinating thing to me, and I feel very honoured and privileged to have had it come into my life. But once Kip started his business, he started a small passenger operation here with Pete Wright as the first pilot, the Australian pilot anyway. And Petey Boy came up, and we started flying, I think it was a 120 or a 160 up here, and then moved to a 240, and then we had a 300, which at that time to me was just a massive balloon, which once again fascinated me on how you could get this big bag of hot air to do what it did and all those sort of things. And then Kip opened a business on the side of Global Ballooning called Picture This Ballooning, which was dedicated more to the special shapes and the corporate side. And subsequently, I started moving around the country with different special shapes and lots of different pilots. And after a while, it ended up crewed in every state and territory in Australia, every capital city, and you know, lots of different regional places. So it became a sort of a Bedouin lifestyle, I think. It was a bit like being in the bush and mustering. You just sort of was travelling the country, going to all these new interesting places and using the resourcefulness that I'd been trained in the bush to you know, make these things happen for the guy I was working for and for the clients that he was contracted to.
It's always nice to travel on somebody else's credit card too.
Yeah, well, I'd been used to, you know, traipsing around the bush in a swag or living in the dirt. So living in the back of a troop carrier was much more luxurious. And subsequently.
Was that the dream that Kif sold you?
No. It was just the processes and the methodology and the way he thought about things was a lot more organised. And I think it goes into the 5P's saying these days of planning and prevent poor performance. Although we had piss poor performance in our spiel, so and that mantra has sort of stayed with me all the way along. I do take maybe to a degree ballooning too seriously, but I'm only in it to give 110%, and if I can't do that, I may as well not be there.
So over those years, I mean, have you ever toyed with the idea of actually becoming a pilot?
Well, originally, Kif used to hassle me to, or I should say encourage me to become a pilot. But the more I sort of looked at it, the more there's probably two facets to that. Firstly, the facet was that I thought I was pretty capable on the ground as far as retrieving balloons, putting them up, dealing with landholders, dealing with uncharted territory, so to speak. And the second one was that I never had a passion to fly, and I find that pilots are people or have a part of their persona that has a passion to fly. I never had that passion, and I was never really interested in the glory, the fame, the money, or any of that sort of thing to it. So I really didn't have that yearning to push myself to learn to fly. The other thing was, at that time, I felt that the responsibility of having people's lives in my hands, it didn't sit well with me. I knew I could keep people alive on the ground, but I didn't really find that I had the confidence, I suppose, to take that responsibility of people in the air.
So on that note, I mean, one of the things that I've always had the mantra of is that, especially when I'm instructing, that a good pilot is somebody that's spent a lot of time on the ground and has experienced a whole lot of, I guess, that life and also been exposed to other experiences. Is that something that you've also seen, that the best people that have become pilots have been people that have had that experience on the ground?
Well, to a degree. Once again, I've noticed, especially over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, that once somebody makes the commitment to themselves to become a pilot, that crew stuff switches off and their focus then goes to the air as opposed to what happens on the ground. There are a few that think that way, and I think one of the things when I am working with or crewing for people who are either training to become a pilot or low-hour pilots, I always just poke that button and say, remember the little people, because that's probably the point that I'm trying to get across in that statement, is that, you know, remember when you were on the ground once and how the behaviour of the pilot and the way the pilot thought, the way the pilot spoke to you, the way the pilot treated you made your experience a more pleasant one than being barked at by someone who thinks he's a, you know, squadron leader in the battle for Britain or something like that, which there's been a couple go past the wayside like that, which really is not a particularly fun way to spend your morning. And at the end of the day, it's about fun. You know, I've always been a person, if I'm not enjoying what I'm doing, well, I may as well not be doing it. So it's never been about anything else other than having fun and being able to do the best you can to support the team, which it is a team sport, because pilots also are fully aware that you can't do it without a team, although bicycles were the team in some cases in the early days.
When did you start getting into the competition side of ballooning? Because that's, I guess, where a lot of the people who are probably listening to this know you from various international events where you're either have 25 pie balls attached to your body or you're standing on top of a van with a wind reader or something of the like. How did you get into the competition ballooning side of the world?
Well, I'd have to thank Pete Wright for that, because when Pete got his commercial license and he was flying up here, which I think was about 99, somewhere around about that, he said to me, "Dino, I want to go and have a go at the competitions." And I'd never even heard of competition. Oh, well, I had, you know, lightly heard about it because some of the guys that I knew had been competing at Saga and things, but I'd never really given it any thought. But by this time, I'd been seriously ballooning, I suppose, for about 5 or 6 years. And I thought, well, you know, this is a really good way of honing skills, both for the pilot and for the crew. And it also gave you the opportunity, particularly being in the commercial world, of not having that focus or distraction of having passengers to look after and the logistics of flying commercially. So it was basically a pilot and a group of people that he'd select out in the middle of wherever the location was. And my first nationals or my first competition was the nationals in 2001 in Mildura. And I am a pretty observant sort of person. So watching the other pilots and watching the crews and watching how the game was played, that really pushed my buttons. And once again, thanks to Pete for exposing me to it, because that really sort of got the juices flowing. And it was also something that I could very much apply to the commercial side of ballooning, whether it was touring with Special Shapes or doing the commercial thing here and there. So that started out. And then I did 2001 with Pete, 2003, the pre-worlds. And after that, it all sort of changed dramatically after Mildura. So, and then it just really got going, because I thought by the time Mildura came around 2004, that was it. You know, I couldn't get any more enjoyment out of the ballooning that I'd been doing. And then it just exploded. And, you know, to this day, I can't wait to see what happens next, because there's lots of stuff out there to do. There's lots on the bucket list. You know, my quiet personal goal would be to help Australia win a world championship, or have an Australian on the podium in the world championships. And I'll keep doing that until my services are no longer required or I'm surplus to requirement. So, yeah.
So talk about that. What caused that explosion? Like, what was it, a change in the way competition was, or that you started travelling internationally, or was it a change of team? What was the premise of that?
I think 03, I sort of started looking at the Shawnee Cavs and the Andrew Robbos and the Paul Gibbses, and looking at their teams. And I got chatting to a few of these high-end teams, and the challenge fascinated me. You know, one, the mental state that a pilot needed to be in, or where he was at, and I'm still trying to work that out, to put himself through the torture of trying to win an Australian or a world champ or any competition for that matter. And I remember, I think it was 2005, Paul Gibbs rang me up and he said to me, "Dino, I wonder if you'd consider joining my team, going to the pre-worlds in Japan." And I was quite honest with him. I said, "No, Paul, I'm not really interested. I've been watching your team and you've got a pretty good dynamic going on there in your team, and I wouldn't like to interrupt that. So, you know, thanks, but no thanks." And my daughter took my wife and I skiing in the Australian Alps And I'd been in the Australian, I'd never been to the snow before, so I was as nervous as all hell about it. And we went down there, and having done a bit of surfing in my past life, I decided to take up a snowboard. And I can remember having been down there for a week, and I was standing in the car park down at Jindabyne, and I'm thinking, wow, my ankles are still intact, my wrists are still intact, I haven't hurt myself. Fantastic. And my phone rang and it was Paul, and he said, I can't stand it any longer. I've booked your ticket to Japan. You're coming to Japan with me. And so that year, I think it was August 2005, I was on my way to Matagi with Paul, and that then opened up a whole, once again, new world of wind readers and mountain flying and amazing scenery and amazing people. And yeah, and that's really what got me going. And I crewed for Paul for a number of events over the years, and really enjoyed it. And thanks to Paul, I increased my skill set, because he's a pretty smart bloke and a very good imparter of knowledge and a good communicator. So once again, I increased my skill set and my experience, and that coupled with my unique style, for want of a better word, improved my worth. And from there on in, I was asked on a number of occasions to, continue doing what I do. And hopefully that'll continue, as long as I don't piss too many people off.
Hi, we hope you're enjoying this episode. Just a quick reminder that you can support Auntie Monkey by going to patreon.com/AuntieMonkey or going to the donate page on AuntieMonkey.com, where you can pledge as little as $1 per episode that will help us get all the software, the hosting, and the equipment that we need to produce better quality podcasts for you. Anyway, enough from us, back to the episode. It's an interesting time that you came into competition, because around that sort of 2003, 2004 time was pretty much where everything started changing. And as you sort of said, people starting to take it a lot more serious. The teams got more well-organized. It's when racer balloons came along. It's when laptops started getting in the basket, wind readers, the whole lot. It was kind of that transition time from going for a whole lot of people just going for a fly and hoping they see a target to suddenly treating it like a proper competition. So it's kind of nice that was when you came into it, was really at that sort of pivotal start of modern competition ballooning.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember Paul saying, Dino, we're using computers. And I went, oh, great. I could hardly turn a computer on in those days, and wind readers. And he said, if I'm competitive in this sport, I have to force myself to learn how to use a computer. And that particular event, I was single crewing for him, so there was only me in the vehicle. I had a moving map with Aussie Explorer on it, and I had a wind reader, both of which I'd never touched before. And we came through that week really well. By the end of the week, I could set a wind reader up with my eyes shut, and between Aussie Explorer and my knowledge of being able to navigate sort of by landmark, I found Paul each time, and we didn't lose any markers, and had a great week. So that was sort of the beginning of it. And like you say, that transition was the realization that it isn't the olden days anymore. And if Australia and these guys are going to be competitive, well, we need to embrace technology and look at where one can gain some advantage by use of technology. And that's, as you know, still going on today with the wind sons and all this other sort of secret squirrel geeky stuff that's out there that the other countries are working on. And that's the way, and that's one of the things I think Kif sort of really pushed my buttons in, was it wasn't about this is the way we've always done it. It's about the innovation. Take the good stuff from the past and develop it and learn. And that's happening today with the newer generations. And I'm pretty curious and excited to see what's next, because there'll be something, that's for sure.
So you mentioned the newer generations, and then that's kind of a nice segue, I guess, to what, who, well, to some people that were the newer generation who aren't so much anymore, which is Matt and Nicholas Scaife, that you have become a fairly pivotal part of the team Scaife, what do we want to call it, bandwagon. how did that all come about?
Well, I was here at Camden, and Graham and Matt, this was probably, I don't know, around about 2007, 2008. And I can remember being down at Benalla at the Nationals in 2007 or 2009, somewhere around there. And Matt had come down with Thomas Dattler to fly a commercial balloon in conjunction with the Benalla event. And there was this young English Rose and his young girlfriend standing there in the dark one day, and Paul was talking to Thomas and Matt and encouraging them to, participate, join in. And subsequently, both of them did. Thomas went on to win, I think, the 2011 Nationals and knocked off Gibbsy by a couple of points. And Matt and Nicola, in their first small balloon, which I think was Mark, which was a Kavanagh 84, branded Kavanagh 84, decided to throw their hat in the ring, and it all started from there. And Matt approached me to come and crew for them at, I think it was the second event they did. I think the first event they did, I was still crewing with Paul. And I saw that, for me personally, is a springboard to the next generation, which now, you know, Matt and Nick are starting to get a bit long in the tooth, but I sort of went from the Kiff and Gibbsy generation to the Matt and Nick generation, and now I've got my eye on the next generation, which we will probably end up talking about a little bit as well.
We sure will. Yeah, and I think the generations are all starting to blur, or as we get older, we like to think they're blurring. But yes, the when Matt and Nicola obviously came along, I know pretty much, I think it's either his second or third event was the Worlds at Battle Creek. And I think it was more surprise to him than it was to us that he found himself in first place in the first few days at the Worlds. How did you see the differing sort of transition from, I guess, the more old school competition to this sort of new sort of eyes wide open younger generation? Was there a big change in the way that you had to perform or how the team operated?
Oh, I think that's a bit of a leading question, to be honest.
I don't know what you're saying.
Well, I think, as you know, that our Matthew, who I love dearly, and his now wife, at that point they weren't married, had a very different approach to some of the guys that I'd been working with previously, where who were very organised or attempted to be as organised as possible, to this young guy who had a very limited knowledge of the rules, but could fly the pants off a balloon. And he had this very cavalier style to him, which once again pushed my buttons, because at that stage, you know, I would have been in my 40s, so I was starting to feel my age, and it revitalized me. It was like, wow, these young guys are a lot more fun, because it's just rolling chaos. And it continues to a certain degree today, although we are a lot more organized than we were however long ago that was, 10 or so years ago. But it's just that it took the edge off the seriousness, I think, of it, or the militaristic way. That's probably not the right way to put it. But, it's a lot of fun. Matt's a lot of fun, and obviously Nick's a lot of fun as well. And, it's a lot more free-flowing style, which can work really well. Other times it can make the work a little bit harder, but it was also a good opportunity for me to sort of move to a younger generation of people and see for myself whether I had the adaptability in me to be able to change my ways do it from a different perspective and do it in a different way. And I think Matt may or may not agree with me, but I think it sort of worked over the last few years.
Well, I think we'll have a podcast with Matt, so he has his right of rebuttal anyway, so you can say whatever you like. And more recently, you've sort of, I guess, moved on to the next generation and have been spending some time in international competitions with, I guess, the what we're calling, I guess, the third generation of balloonists in Australia.
Yes, well, that's very exciting. My lemmings, who I love my lemmings dearly, and once again, they've proven great ambassadors for the sport. And as you pointed out, the older generations, there was a period there where there wasn't such a generation coming on through the ranks. And fortunately, through Kiff and his family, the lemmings have been born. And Patterson, Edward, Scarlett, Mia and Harry have developed this great relationship between themselves, which is interesting and quite seductive to the younger generation. And that's created quite a clutch of lemmings, not only in the Yarra Valley, but now starting to grow outside the Yarra Valley and touch the younger generation in other states. And it's great. And Patterson, I think, asked me when they just got their licenses about 3 or 4 years ago to would I come and crew for him at the Nationals. And, of course, being very close to the family, I was very privileged, honoured and chuffed to be invited to begin with to hang around with all those young people and, secondly, to be a part of the beginning of their journey in the competition world. And we went up to Canoundra and to the Canoundra Challenge. And he had a young lady with him by the name of Georgia Croft, who was going to crew with me. Right from day one, Georgia had it. She was smart. She had a lot of common sense. And now she is, I think, the first Victorian or first female commercial pilot in global ballooning. And, it all went from there. So I've done a couple of Canoundras with them. Unfortunately, I was not able to take part in the Nationals in Northam or in Mudgee with them because I had commitments elsewhere, but did have the privilege of going to the Junior Worlds with the Lemmings, was that last year or the year before, which, once again, was a great time. So, again, it sort of adds to my longevity if I can play my part with the different generations. And I've got my eye on the next generation now because they're starting to get old. And I got my eye on Hugo. He's my next big hope for a world champion if you guys can't do it.
Is this a motivation for everyone just to keep breeding, to keep you going?
Yeah, well, I want to see how many generations I can get through. You know, at the moment, I've got a pretty good feeling I'm going to live forever. So, yeah, keep punching them out and I'll keep crewing for them.
So then last year in Mudgee, you actually swapped sides and became an official at the Australian Nationals. How was that in contrast to being somebody actively involved in being part of the crew?
Matt was very keen to experience the other side of ballooning, i.e. the organisation and the official side of things. And he gave me a call and he said, well, I'm looking at, there's no, well, firstly, there was, pardon me, nothing else to do the Australian Nationals. And to his credit, he stepped up to the plate. And I was very impressed that he was prepared to make that sacrifice, given how well he was going in the competition world, and was more than happy to support him. So I said, sure, mate. And to be honest, as far as my involvement in ballooning goes into the future, as I get older and into my twilight years, I really was sort of eyeing up being able to contribute to ballooning by being able to offer myself as an official or part of the event team when I was old and useless and could no longer compete or contribute on the paddock. But having said that, when we did do it, and I enjoyed every moment of it, really did, enjoyed working with Gary Lacey and Gren Putland and the rest of the team. But it was, to me, it was like being a pig dog left on the chain during a pig hunt because, yeah, I wasn't used to be standing there watching balloons fly away from me. I was used to being in the middle of it with my sleeves rolled up. So it was a very different sensation. And one,
not being able to tell the pilots what to do from the ground.
Well, you know, not being able to play my part or do my role, I suppose, was an interesting thing. But once again, it was very nice because there was a good quality field. The lemmings were there, and I could spend a bit of time on the ground chatting with them. And as you're probably aware, when you're in competition mode, you don't get that much of a chance to really chat and socialise with people because you've got your own team logistics to work on. So it was a really nice opportunity not to be running around like a blue-ass fly and being able to stop and chat and talk to people and see what hard work these event teams do to allow us to go out and do what we love doing.
So I guess one of the things I wanted to talk to you, sort of shifting gears a little bit, is around what makes good crew. And I think we can look at this from both a professional point of view, from a commercial side, as well as competition, which in many aspects, from what I can see, doesn't vary that much. But how would you define, having seen good and bad people on the ground, what are the real sort of standout things that you think are qualities that good crew will have?
Well, to start with, I don't think there's any such thing as bad people on the ground. I have to remind myself on a regular basis that people are involved in ballooning because it interests them. It's a beautiful thing, and there's fun to be had. So I think the good and bad's a pretty harsh term. I don't exactly know what would be the right term, but that's always been one of my mantras, is that every day I go out ballooning, I have to give my all, and I say to myself that you're only as good as your last flight. So the things that you did well in the flight before, try and build on. The things that you didn't do right before, try and avoid. So at all times, you're really looking at developing skills and just making yourself a better person. And I think that's one thing that ballooning's done for me, is it's perpetuated that. But I think good crew starts with common sense. People that don't have a great deal of common sense tend to have to work a lot harder at developing those skills. Another thing I think is good mentors. And I've been very privileged in my journey through ballooning to have met some really, really, I'll use the word clever, but I'd say very skilled people in the craft of crewing. One that particularly comes to mind is Chris Peaky, who you may or may not have met in your journey.
Peaky used to crew for me down in the Yarra Valley, so I know Peaky well.
Yeah, so he's a little bit rough around the edges and gets no point for delivery, but his methodology and the thought process behind what he's trying to impart on other people, I found very helpful and beneficial to me when I was learning the craft. Kel Lewis would be another one. Once again, they're both people from the bush, so they have great common sense, they have great situational awareness, and the other thing that really makes good crew is time and experience. So, you know, being in a position where you can build your skills or work at seeking out people or knowledge that help you build those skills, a willingness to learn, and an ability to take criticism. Because when I say criticism, I believe in positive reinforcement as opposed to negative reinforcement. So listening to people and attempting to emulate what they're trying to communicate to you. And, don't get too hard and set in your point where you actually think that your way is the best way or the only way, because every pilot's different, every flight's different, every situation's different. So you have to be flexible and fluid at the same time. So, you know, being able to read the play, planning, preparation, prevent piss poor performance. So, you know, all those things come into play. And nowadays in the competition world, as you said, in 04, 05, it all sort of started to change a lot. But I think also fatigue management and being in reasonable physical condition to undertake a lot of this sort of thing now is very important, because the stakes are a lot higher.
One of the things that I've always been very impressed with the way in competition, that I know everybody tries to beat you, but in some amazing way, you are always the first at a target and you're always there and well and truly set up and established before any other teams show up. And it's not because of your driving, but I think there's something I've always watched is that you understand what's happening and you understand and anticipate what's going to happen. And you seem to be very good at reading and understanding where the balloons are going and what's the best way to get there. And would you put that down to experience, or is that something that you instinctively have kind of understood?
Well, for starters, I don't think it's a drag race. And at no stage have I really driven in a dangerous manner or in a manner where I've, you know, scared my observers or scared my other crew. So I think you've probably hit it on the head. It's about anticipation and reading the play. And, a lot of that skill came out of being in the bush and being aware of what's around you and how to anticipate the movements of stock, weather conditions, danger, all those sort of things. So, yeah, it's about... Once again, experience does come into it as eventually, but having the ability to read the play and time and motion, of course, you know, faffing around is a very good way of putting yourself behind the eight ball when you are moving through one of these competitions, because you can get caught in the traffic, the rules can shift. Hesitation waltzes are a classic example of that, but organised these days too, so I find it easier these days to do all those things than I did, 10 years ago. So it's and practice, practice your skills. You don't have to have a balloon in the air to do that. You know, you can pore over your maps, you can make sure your gear's right, you can get your compass out, you can, track clouds, all those sort of things. And be physically fit. And eat well, don't get too fat. At the end of the day, it's about the podium for a lot of these aeronauts, which I have a great respect for, people to be able to put themselves in the mindset to want to put themselves through that torture to try and achieve that goal. But for me, it's about a team, and it's about me contributing or doing my part to the best of my ability to support those people in that goal. So I'm not a competitive person by any means, but I'm competing with myself to do the best job I possibly can and then go out the next day and do it better.
So at this stage in the podcast, I typically ask people what next, but I'm starting to get the impression from yourself that you're sort of always looking forward to seeing what happens next and with no specific plans. But in your mind, is there something that you're really looking forward to in the next couple of years that is really sort of keeping your passion and hopes alive with the ballooning?
I don't think it needs any keeping alive. I'm as passionate about ballooning as I was 10, 15 years ago. I just want to chase balloons. I don't give a shit where it is, what it is, or how it is. I want to chase them. And sure, there's a few things on the bucket list, which remain to be seen whether they pull off. But at this stage, I love it, and I just want to keep doing it. And as you said, it's a bit of a movable feast, especially in the times we're in at the moment. Each year I started the year going, there might be this and there might be that. But by halfway through the year, the dance card's full, and it's a matter of trying to juggle everything and fit things in. But primarily not to let anybody down, as much as if I do commit to doing something, then I will do it. I'm not going to turn around and go, so-and-so's offered me to go and do this, so see you later. So I think loyalty is something that I was instilled on me when I was very young, and I see that as a badge of honour and wear it as a badge of honour. So I say to anybody who's really got any projects that they've got in mind, the earlier in the year that you can let me know, the better, because that way I can slot them into the dance card and not let anybody else down. So, yeah, looking forward to this year. Is a bit of a different year. There are lots of interesting things on the agenda for this year, but I think that's all a bit of a movable feast now with the coronavirus and what have you. So we'll just have to see what happens. But last year, my journey took me through 14 different countries, and I was hoping to beat that this year, but it's not to be. We'll see what happens. There's a few projects that have been bandied around that could be very interesting. But one of my major goals is to spend more time on the Arabian Peninsula. I have a fascination for the Arabian Peninsula, and there's a lot of cool things to do over there.
Thank you very much today, Dino, for joining us. As I sort of said before, we certainly could talk for hours and go in many directions, but I think that's really given a good insight into sort of the way you approach things and some of your past. So thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you, Ballooning, and thank you all you aeronauts out there, because if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. So thanks very much. Safe flying.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode of Auntie Monkey. We plan to bring out a whole lot of new content for you over the coming weeks, so please stay tuned. You can follow us on our Facebook page at Auntie Monkey, or on our website at auntiemonkey.com, where you can see all of our previous episodes. And remember, you can always subscribe in your podcasting app on both Apple and Android. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.